from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working with students and families to improve college access and student success for a better West Virginia. West Virginia University, online at wvu.edu.
Good evening and welcome to the legislature today. I'm Andrea Lanham at the Capitol Building in Charleston. If you know the Capitol Building, you're familiar with its stunning chandelier, but you haven't seen it lately. We'll have that story later in the program, but first, with the teacher strike over and schools back in operation, the story here is the budget. Both the House and Senate are considering their versions in these last few days of the session. Joining us now to discuss some of the differences and perhaps some areas where the two chambers can agree are Senate Finance Vice Chair Greg Bozzo and House Finance Minority Chair Mick Bates. Thank you guys so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So it's a little bit calmer today, of course, you know, with the teacher walkout happening yesterday and that ending. But following the passage of that teacher pay raise bill yesterday, now all eyes are on the budget since the Senate Finance Chair warned of some deep cuts. What's the progress so far in the House and Senate? I'll start with you, Senator.
Okay. Obviously the budget that we have right now is that which the governor provided to us that we're taking a look at. There are a few little odds and ends, particularly in special revenue accounts, that we're working through the various details. But for the most part, what's on the floor right now is the governor's budget bill. We passed it out last night, read the second time today, and so we're pretty anxious to get the budget bill completed, get it over to the House, and let them take it up. And it's the governor's bill as modified. It's obviously got some changes in it as compared to what we received during his State of the State address. It has some cuts in it, but it also has across the board a 5% pay raise for all public employees, save, of course, the regional jails and corrections officers who get a $2,000 pay increase this particular year.
Now, Delegate, you brought a lot of reading material with you.
Yeah, this is what we've been working right through, and I think you'll agree that some of the calculations have been delayed because of negotiations going on with pay raises, because they flow all the way through the budget. It's not just the teachers and the troopers, it's all state workers that have to be accounted for. So my understanding is that normally we would run the House budget this year, but because of what's been going on, the discussions with downstairs, we're actually going to flip the process. The Senate's going to send theirs over to us. We've been working on a strike and insert. That's come back off the table. I understand there's an agreement between the House and the Senate for us to pretty much take their budget, insert it into ours, and send it back. So there are changes to that, but we have gone right back to the governor's introduced budget rather than our working document, which was the strike and insert, with some changes to a few line items and the adjustment letter that came yesterday from the governor's office indicating where he was going to make some allocations or changes. So, we're sort of digging our way through this and making sure that everything's covered and taken care of and that we can pay for these pay increases. So I think the big thing that is probably a difference of opinion between the Senate and the House, and I believe the House is going to take the Senate's position on this, is the inclusion of the $58 million worth of additional revenue that the governor has found in his revenue estimates. I believe we're going to work with a $4.38 million top line, and that's the Senate's position, and position I think the House is going to end up ultimately taking.
Yeah, the 4.38 obviously is the what the governor's revised budget was as it came back across. Through the course of the negotiations over the course of the last couple of days, as we were able to pay the teachers and all of our public employees their addition, a 5% raise across the board. We do have that, back. Obviously, the governor had to take some losses within his budget that was presented to us back in January in order to get there. And so the strike and insert, as the delegate alluded to, obviously has the governor's proposal on how those revenues, or those expenditures rather, would be accomplished.
So let's talk about some of those losses. I know we've talked about them a little bit before, just about cuts to additional funding with tourism, commerce, and some other revenue measures measures with fiscal notes in them, like the business inventory tax. Talk about some of the losses that you were alluding to.
Well, the business and inventory tax obviously isn't. We know that the business and inventory tax is still applicable, and we've got that revenue there, so we really haven't removed anything. It required a constitutional amendment in order to accomplish that, so it's not going to be part of the discussion. But obviously, tourism had a loss. The governor had some anticipated additional expenditures in that particular program, not only tourism, but also in the Department of Commerce, where the governor really wanted to accomplish some additional work to build infrastructure throughout the state of West Virginia, do some site identification and make them ready to put infrastructure into so that we can attract business and industry into West Virginia. But unfortunately, you know, we've got to live within our means rather than going out and saying, well, you know, the $58 million that the governor identified as additional revenue, we need to take advantage of. We didn't take that position. We've held that $58 million additional revenue is suspicious. And we'll wait and see. The governor says it's there, but we have our concerns. And so what we've done is we've allowed that $58 million to reside in the spending document uncommitted. And what that allows us to do is that as we go through the course of the year, obviously, a reasonable way to do that is when the governor or some of the programs have a need for funds, we can do special allocations throughout the course of the year, take those measures up and make sure that those agencies are able to operate.
So there were, again, the numbers are very fluid, and this is all coming together in the last 24 hours, but I understand there's about $53 million that have come out of the commerce budget, which is the tourism, mm-hmm. site development issues that the Senator was referring to. There's about $10 million that are coming out of general services. These were for some delayed, deferred maintenance on capital projects or government buildings around the Capitol and other places. There were two bills that we ran over in the House. One was a workers' comp redirect, surcharges on workers' compensation premiums and self-insured employers. That was flowing into the workers' comp old fund debt reduction plan. There was a bill that we ran that was about $12 million, and the redirect of state road funds. So there's about $13 mm-hmm. million there that would normally go to state road, but because of the bonding that's going to be out there, right. we're no longer directing that money from general revenue across to state road. And then there's about $10 million coming out of the back end of Medicaid. Now, Medicaid's a big, big program. So we appropriate this large sum of money. It's a 3-to-1 federal match. So you don't spend it all up front. So what you can do, and this is a pretty common practice through the years, is to put that out there as sort of an IOU with the understanding that as we move through the year, once we get closer to the line, then if necessary, we can do something to close that. So, from the best I can tell through this process, I'm not seeing any indication, and I have some confirmation of this from leadership, is that there should not be any disruption in services to the citizens of West Virginia with these cuts. There are cuts, but they're really more spending we're not going to be doing. So they're not necessarily in the base themselves as we move forward.
Right. And to that point, you know, one of the things that we need to take into consideration is that, you know, we asked, Medicare is taking a little bit of a cut, but when you talk about a program as massive as it is, the $10 million that they're talking about rolling back is fairly minimal as compared to looking at $1.7, $1.8 billion really program of that magnitude. One of the nice things, too, in addition, the delegate listed very aptly the number of cuts that came back out. But in addition to that, there's a $2 million rollback that the West Virginia Supreme Court said that they weren't going to need this upcoming year.
It's a furnishing budget.
And so I think it's an olive branch that they've thrown to us, if you will. But, you know, so we're having an impact as we lead the state forward.
You've definitely provided a lot of clarity on this Medicaid issue, because I know there was a lot of questions about that. Now, I know another bill that has been cut from this budget proposal is the community college bill to incentivize attendance of that. Delegate, can you talk about some of the importance in Southern West Virginia?
Yeah, I mean, certainly our vocational schools are essential to mm-hmm. building a workforce. The House, in fact, didn't take that up with any real consideration, so it really was a non-starter on our side. I think the fiscal not attached to that was about $7 million.
As I understand.
Yeah, and that's the Free Community Technical College program that was an initiative of the Senate President. But there was not a lot of love shown on the other side of the building for that program, is the way it came across. So that's $7 million that we don't have to find funding for, because we're not going to move forward with that initiative. I think mm-hmm. we'll probably revisit the issue of vocational and technical schools if the money's available later in the year, but I don't think that that's a bill that we're certainly not at this point is going to be needing funding, because the bill didn't make its way through the process.
Now, I heard you earlier say that you might be taking, the House might be taking the position of the Senate as far as these revised revenue estimates go. Now, I understand the House was a little bit more trusting of those estimates at first.
Well, I think the general position of the House, and if we put it up for a vote today, I think we would take the $58 million and we would allocate it through the budgetary process. I think leadership in the Senate and the House have, as part of this compromise, to get the 5% pay increase for the teachers and those people included in that bill, as well as the 5% for everybody else. The accommodation was made to not include that $58 million in the budget itself. So that was, I think, part of the agreement that solidified the deal that was cut yesterday, that's put our teachers back in the schools and made this place a whole lot quieter today than it was yesterday. So I think that that's the position of the House, not necessarily because it's the position of the House, but because that's the position we need to take to get this thing done and put to bed.
So we've talked a lot about cuts. What about revenue measures? Are we going to see any of that happening over the course of the next few days?
Well, the revenue measures are those which the governor has identified. Delegate Bates really identified a couple of the other revenue enhancements that through legislation that we passed that will be put back in there in order to get to the $4.381 billion general revenue budget that we've got before us. Obviously, there's a number of other issues that are of concerns you know, we've fully funded PEIA. We've taken $21 million and committed to that this current year so that all of our public employees have assurance that over the course of the next year, we're able to take care of that. But there's not a lot of revenue beyond that which the governor has identified that we're utilizing right now within the general revenue budget.
Now, very quickly, it sounds like the House and the Senate have come to a lot of agreements on this. Do you think that this is going to get done by Saturday?
I believe it could be done by Saturday night. I think it could be done by Saturday afternoon, the way things are looking right now. I'm not seeing that there's going to be the necessity for the huge fights that we've had the last couple of years over this. And certainly, that all starts with the governor's revenue estimate. So we have that number to work with and back down from. So I'm optimistic that we may not be here in the early hours of the morning.
Well, thank you guys so much. That's unfortunately going to have to be the last word. Thank you both so much for being here. I've definitely learned a lot today. Again, we have Delegate Mick Bates and Senator Greg Bozzo. Thank you both.
Thank you.
A bill to establish a palliative care advisory coalition passed the House today and is on its way to the governor's desk for a signature. This type of care is focused on providing relief from the symptoms and stress of a serious illness. The goal of this kind of care is to improve quality of life for both the patient and family. The passage is considered a win by senior organizations and advocates, but these same advocates say there's another huge need out there for additional funding for senior centers and the vital services they provide. Rebecca Turnbull reports.
Rising minimum wage requirements, city user fees, and food costs over the past few years have senior centers struggling to stay open with their current state appropriations. The centers provide essential state-funded services to about 30,000 seniors across the state through meal programs, in-home care, and social activities. But some of those programs have not seen much-needed funding increases in over a decade.
We've been fortunate we haven't had major cuts, but we've not had rate increases in our meal program since 2006. We've not had rate increases in our in-home program since 2011.
The West Virginia Bureau of Senior Services receives state money to be used for reimbursement rates to those programs. However, Bureau officials say that lawmakers cut their appropriations significantly during mid-year budget reductions in 2015. Since then, appropriations have stayed flat. Until the state can increase its funding to the Bureau, officials here say that they cannot afford to bring rates back up to where they need to be, causing a great threat to their services.
We're just like everyone else. Our costs have went up. We're losing people because we can't give raises, just like the teachers and the state employees. So we're hitting that wall where if we don't receive increased funding, services are going to decline.
According to center administrators, the lack in funding forces the facilities to compete with other businesses, such as fast food restaurants, to hire and keep paid employees. But because baby boomers are beginning to use senior services, more workers will be needed to ensure the state's aging population is taken care of. They say they're resorting to unpaid volunteers to keep the doors open.
It gets difficult as your senior population grows to provide services to those in need, especially disabled and physically disabled and folks who can't leave their home. So we're trying to look at different ways to partner in our community.
Governor Justice's proposed appropriation to the Bureau for fiscal year 2019 is basically flat. When compared with last year's budget, senior programs are only seeing a $1,109 increase in a total net budget of about $30.5 million from state lottery and racetrack funds. Some lawmakers say they hope to see those appropriations increase in the future once the state gains a better financial footing. Senior Issues Chair Ruth Rowan says the investment yields a significant return that goes beyond simple care for seniors.
This is a win-win situation. This is where our seniors want to be. They want to be at home with their cat, their dog, things they couldn't have at a nursing home. It's better for them, it's healthier for them, and actually it's cheaper for our state if they stay at home where they're happy.
And for those seniors still able to leave their homes and visit senior centers, some say they will continue to come to the centers for comfort and companionship they might not have access to otherwise.
It's important because a lot of us do live alone, and we come out and socialize, meet people here at lunchtime, but we do other activities here in this facility as well, in the senior center.
The U.S. Census Bureau estimates that seniors ages 65 and older will comprise nearly half of West Virginia's population by the year 2030. With this in mind, members of senior centers around the state will be looking to the legislature in this and upcoming sessions to provide the funding needed to take care of that growing population. For the Legislature Today, I'm Rebecca Turnbull in Charleston.
Joining us now is Senator Mike Wolfel of Cabell County. Senator, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we have a lot to talk about today. The House unanimously passed Senate Bill 36, and I will mention the companion bill a little bit later, and that's another piece of legislation that you sponsored. But before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about this bill and what it does. Now it relates to DNA testing.
Yes, this is a bill that essentially was worked out last year among the different stakeholders, and we got it to the finish line in the Senate very early in the session. And today I'm glad to hear that it's been passed by the House. We do not treat our sexual assault victims in this state very well. So what we're doing is modernizing the manner in which we handle their cases. For example, at this point, there's an average 440-day delay for a rape kit or forensic medical examination kit to be tested by the state police lab. So what this bill will do, it'll set up rulemaking by the SAFE Commission, which will bring that number down to maybe 180 days. Can you imagine a victim of sexual assault who has to wait basically, when it all is said and done, about 2 years to go to trial? Many of our victims have turned the page on their life at that point. Not to mention the sexual predators that are out there, not convicted, doing God knows what. So the main thing it'll do is speed the process up considerably. Number two, the state police lab is understaffed, and this bill allows the Marshall Forensic Science Center to test DNA for DNA on rape kits, which that center is testing rape kits from around the country at this point. So it allows the state police, if they're too busy, to delegate that to the Forensic Science Center at Marshall.
So you had talked about a delay of like 440 days.
The average delay, and I have a client right now in my law practice that has waited 2 years for the DNA to come back. DNA came back just a few weeks ago, pinpointed the rapist, got a match, matched a suspect, and he was arrested, I think, yesterday. But it's been 2 full years. So yeah, that's the average.
Was it such a delay?
The lab is understaffed. There has been a major backlog of rape kits being tested around the state and the country. Our state has really made that a priority to get those results back to prosecutors. It's unconscionable, but that's the state of the law, and this bill will change that dramatically.
Now, another piece of legislation, as I mentioned before, is this companion bill, which is Senate Bill 39, and that's the Sexual Assault Bill of Rights. It's been pending before House Judiciary, but it doesn't look like it's moved since January. Is there any word of movement on that bill?
Well, this is the Sexual Assault Survivors Bill of Rights, which was passed by the Congress unanimously a couple of years ago. So last session, I modeled our bill for that under that, and it passed the Senate, as did this, 34-0. I'm told that it's not going to be run in the House, which I'm shocked and disappointed. Basically, that bill, and it's only two pages, but it allows a rape victim, again, to modernize the way we treat rape victims in our state. It allows a rape victim to have a friend or a social worker or a teacher, if it's a young girl, present in the exam room at the hospital, and to make the situation a little bit less intimidating. That's an example of a right that's not really guaranteed at this point to a rape. It's hard, rape is so underreported. These bills are designed to modernize the way we treat these victims.
So why isn't that bill running?
You'd have to ask the Speaker of the House, I'm told by the Chair in Judiciary, because we got this bill out January the 25th. It was reported to the House of Judiciary Committee. So here we are in March. All this time has gone by. It's never been put on an agenda. So, you know, the Speaker, you'd have to answer that question on why it's not been given a priority. We still have time to do it. And this time last year, I was on this same show pleading with the Speaker to run this bill, and it didn't run. You know, we're working tonight in Senate Judiciary. We're running 19 bills. There's no excuse for not running bills today such as this and move the legislation into law.
Well, that'll have to be the last word. Thank you so much for talking about these bills tonight.
Thank you for shedding the light on it.
And again, we have Senator Mike Wolfel from Cabell County. Thank you again.
Thank you.
The gorgeous 80-year-old Capitol chandelier has been temporarily removed for cleaning, and the dome that housed the crystal fixture is now getting ready for repairs. Daniel Walker captured the removal, and Liz McCormick takes us there.
For more than 85 years, the West Virginia Capitol Building has housed the iconic crystal chandelier, illuminating the rotunda for generations of lawmakers and visitors who pass below. Its presence a fixture in the State House. But now, it's coming down. It's not obvious, but the inner dome is actually a false ceiling suspended from cables, hanging between the main dome and the 4,000-pound chandelier below. Time and water damage has taken its toll over the years, corroding the wires that support the Capitol's inner dome, making it sag. John Myers is secretary to the Department of Administration.
Part of the problem we've had with the dome, water as it rains, does not necessarily stay on the outside of the dome. It does come into the interior part, but there are drains made to take that water away. Over a period of, you know, 60, 80, 100 years, it's those drains have deteriorated to the point that water is now leaking into the interior dome. So now you can see some of the paint starting to peel. If you look up above us here, the plaster starting to fall away from the wall. So those things have to be repaired along with replacement of those drains that are back on the inside of the wall. In order to do that, we have to take the chandelier down. While it's down, we need to do some repairs to the chandelier itself. It needs to be refurbished and restored back to its original condition.
A company called AccuBright specializes in chandelier cleaning and restoration. They've been charged to care for the fixture until it can be returned to its home under the dome. Keith Campbell is the owner of AccuBright.
What we're doing here today and the next day is we're going to take off all the crystal panels, protect them, pack them up, take the framework apart. Then we're going to take the inside body where all the lights and the framework that holds the lights out. Then we're going to remove the column, take all those brass pieces out, take down the pipe. So now it's ready to put up the scaffolding and nothing will get damaged.
The crystal in the rotunda chandelier is known as Czechoslovakian crystal, a high-quality glass that's known for its brilliance, but also lead content. The base component in crystal is silica, the same as in regular glass, but crystal is partially composed of lead oxide. This gives it greater clarity and sparkle. The age and uniqueness of the rotunda chandelier's more than 10,000 pieces make repair and replacement almost impossible.
Many times we come in after something was set up, a ladder was put in or scaffolding, and someone's knocked the priceless chandelier and you just can't get parts for these type of fixtures anymore. So they've hired us to come in and take it apart, and rewire it while it's down, because the old wiring is inside of it, and protect it for the time, the duration of the project.
Once Campbell's team is done dismantling and packing up the chandelier, it will be transported to an undisclosed location where it will be examined, cleaned, rewired, and stored until its return in 2 years. Secretary Myers says the main rotunda will eventually be blocked off, and scaffolding will be erected so that restoration can begin. So for now, the rotunda is dark, lit by only a few work lights and scattered beams of sunlight from the porticos above. Below, lawmakers pass underneath, occasionally glancing up into the void where the chandelier used to be. For the Legislature Today, I'm Liz McCormick in the rotunda.
That does it for tonight's Legislature Today. We'll continue to follow the budget bill deliberations and all the other activity here at the Capitol and bring that to you tomorrow at 6 on day 58 of this 60-day session. I'm Andrea Lanham for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us and have a great evening.